by Gannett, the nation's biggest newspaper company. I'm John Kennedy, coming to you from Gannett's State Capitol Bureau, and I'm joined today by Antonio Finn, his political editor of the Palm Beach Post. Good to have you here, Antonio.
Hey, John, how's it going?
So we've had another long week of protests around the country and in several Florida cities following the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis, who was buried this week in his Houston hometown, but whose legacy could include substantial changes in urban police tactics, maybe even a whole new kind of American police force in the century ahead. And also, of course, we have the coronavirus pandemic here in Florida showing signs of picking up again, as we're seeing this state and other states increase testing and their reopenings. And Florida is among 21 states now that have seen their cases rise in the first few days of June. And lastly, we'll be talking about Florida being in focus again, with Jacksonville now appearing like the landing spot for a big part of this summer's Republican National Convention to nominate, who else? Florida man Donald Trump for a second term. But first, it's time for us to pick a number that had some meaning in Florida politics this week. Antonio, you go first. What do you got?
I'm going to go with 818.
818. That's an intriguing one. Antonio, my number is 36,869.
So that's very precise. Very precise number there, John.
Exactly. And we'll come back later in the show to explain what the meaning of these numbers are across Florida in this past week. But South Florida cities this past week, like many across the U.S., were the scene of almost daily protests, marches that were centered around the Black Lives Matter theme, with calls for major overhauls to policing and in the relationship between law enforcement and Black Floridians. But yeah, you know, it's interesting. Unlike Minneapolis, New York, Atlanta, Philadelphia, other cities, things seem to stay, well, relatively calm here. Do you have any theories as to why things didn't explode in Florida, which is, you know, not usually known for having events that don't go off the rails, it seems?
Yeah, look, I think there's a various theories of why this is happening, but I'm going to focus on one in particular that we've seen. Now, to give you a little bit of background, you know, Palm Beach County, because it is now the adopted home of the President of the United States, who travels here very frequently between November and April, where he'll spend almost every other weekend at Mar-a-Lago, which is his private club and now also his Florida home now. So we are very used to seeing protesters out at all times during the weekends when the president's here. And generally, they line what's between the Palm Beach International Airport and Mar-a-Lago. It's connected by one road. It's Southern Boulevard. It's State Road 98 for those who are familiar with it. And as the president arrives, you know, this is a place that Southern Boulevard is a place where people congregate. People who support the president show up in large numbers. People who oppose the president also show up in, you know, in large numbers. So we're very accustomed to seeing protests here. But what's really interesting was early this year, between January and March, when the president arrived, actually going back to December and November, we saw a curious thing. And that was that a lot of the Trump supporters would be out there. But even with, now we're going to go to ancient history, what appears to be ancient history, but remember the impeachment?
Sure.
Even during that time, the number of anti-Trump protesters seemed smaller week after week than what we had been accustomed to. So one of our reporters actually went out and did a story. We started talking to all the groups that had been leading protests all the way back to the 2017, the women's marches and so forth, and asking, well, you know, now that we have an impeachment trial, a historic impeachment trial, why aren't the protesters out there? And what they told us was that they were focusing all their energies on the elections, on voter registration, on recruiting candidates, on, you know, basically getting people accustomed to the issues. And basically, they were just focused on the elections and not street protests. And I think that's one of the reasons why you're not so much seeing a lot of protesting in the streets of South Florida these days. I mean, we did at the beginning, you know, a few weeks ago in Miami, West Palm Beach. And in fact, there will be, we just learned this morning that there is a scheduled protest in Lake Worth, which is a Palm Beach County city, this coming Saturday. So there are protests. But I think one of the reasons why you're not seeing large numbers and a persistent like in other Florida cities is because a lot of these groups have really been focused on voter registration and the 2020 election.
Now, we have not seen the kind of confrontations between police and demonstrators in this state that have been so alarming, as we've seen in Washington, New York, Atlanta. I mean, the history of the Black community and police in this state is not particularly great. Looking back over the last, about 7 years, there's been, just since 2013, there's been 169 Black Floridians killed by police officers across the state in various confrontations. And that amounts to about 31% of those that are in these confrontations with police. So it's a significant issue. However, it seems maybe, as you're suggesting, that the organizers, the progressives in this state, the Black community is not so much focused as these on these street demonstrations, and maybe to a degree the police here have become somewhat accustomed to standing back and allowing these demonstrations to take place. We didn't see the kind of looting, the kind of real tear gassing, hard altercations between the two sides. And I'm not too sure what we can take away from that. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, look, I mean, I grew up in Miami, and I remember very much 40 years ago the Liberty City riots after the acquittal of four officers who had been charged with murder in the beating death of a Black motorist, Arthur McDuffie. And then 2 years later, there was another police-involved shooting of a young African-American, a young man, and that led to more rioting of what we saw in other cities. And then I remember the infamous 1989 riots in the middle of a Super Bowl week, and you had the ESPN reporters and the sports reporters doing their stand-ups and fires in the background. This is a region that has had its share of rioting. And in fact, correct me if I'm wrong, but that quote that the president himself cited, when the looting starts, the shooting starts, I do even believe that phrase dates back to riots in Miami in 1967, if I'm correct.
Right.
So we certainly have had that history. It's been there that we haven't seen. And we saw some of this in looting in Bayside and in Miami at the very beginning of the George Floyd protest. It has quelled down, and perhaps it's because we know that history that history shows that that kind of violence at the end of the day resolves nothing other than to create more hardship for people. But we've also seen in the state that the wheels of legislation to address some of these issues have moved very slowly, in some cases not at all.
It's interesting you say that, because a Black senator, Randolph Bracey, a Democrat from Orlando, said that the legislature needed a special session to enact reforms in police practices and really address the criminal justice system overall. But Democrats, who are vastly outnumbered in Tallahassee, often try to get special sessions going only to have Republican leaders turn them back. And that's what happened here. Bracey had a list of ideas, mandatory body cameras, more dashboard cameras required on city police cars, and public access to these videos, along with demanding that police shootings be investigated by independent agencies. But none of those ideas look like they're going to take shape anytime in the near future, at least in the form of a debate during a special session. But I wonder, do you think that this is the stage for reform coming to this state?
It would be, but like you just mentioned, you've got to have the legislature call itself into session to address these issues. And we saw that, for example, in Parkland. Now, the shooting in Parkland 2 years ago happened during the session. So, the lawmakers were already there. And we did see some measure, gun control measures that did pass that spring. You know better. You're up there. You're watching this live. But, I mean, the Democrats could not even get the legislature to call itself into special session to deal with, for example, the unemployment benefit system, which has been a debacle and has affected the livelihoods of millions of people in the state. I don't see where they're going to call themselves back into session to deal with police reform issues, particularly in an election year. And let's face it, you know, a lot of police officers, a lot of retired police officers are part of the Republican voting base.
Yeah, it's hard to change that, and very hard to shift what has been a historic view of police in the state, especially by members of the Republican Party, which are always courting that tough on crime law enforcement image. But the entire George Floyd death and the aftermath seems to have really shined a light on a number of changes that need to be made just in the relationship between police and their communities. And I think it is an issue that is going to carry some weight into the next legislative session. Now, that's not going to be until spring of 2021 at this point, which seems very far on the horizon. But there are some, you know, clearly some major issues that have been exposed by the events of the last couple of weeks. Well, turning to the other big topic that has consumed everyone right for months now, the coronavirus. This week, Florida continued on a disturbing new trend of adding more than 1,000 new cases every day. That's something that we've been seeing since basically June 2nd, and it parallels both Governor DeSantis's expanded reopening of the state's economy and what has been an increase in testing. Antonio, what does this tell us about where we are with the virus right now?
This is pandemic Darwinism. You know, basically what the governor and the president right behind him, what they have done is they're rolling the dice. We're going to reopen the economy, get everybody back to work. And then, you know, there will be a spike. And that's just a fact of life. They're willing to roll the dice on this. Now, you know, there are certain barometers that we're looking at. One of them is the hospital utilization rate, meaning the percentage of hospital beds that are available to deal with a spike in coronavirus cases. We've talked about this and that in several times in the past few weeks and the last month, but, you know, that number of available beds is somewhere been in the 30%. This week, it's dropped down to about 26%. So the question is, what is the magic number? What's the magic number of hospital availability where all of a sudden the governor and the leaders of this state have to hit the brakes and say, hold on, you know, now we have a public health emergency. I don't know what that number is, and the governor has certainly never talked about it. So we'll see. We know that the number of new unemployment benefit claims in Florida was 111,000, which is the lowest we've seen in a week since the shutdown. So since the shutdown began, I should say. So that's a gambit. You know, it's pandemic Darwinism. We're going to open the economy. We're going to go back to our lives. And who gets infected or not, and how far we go with this, we'll have to see.
And what does it say about the fall when schools returning to on-campus classes, any kind of substantial rebound for the state's economy, tourists coming back to Florida hotels and, football? You know, what does it all mean for are people going to feel comfortable in all these different venues?
Well, I'm going to feel very comfortable watching football from my couch. I mean, I want to see. Look, I'm like everybody else, man. I want to see football. I want to see life return to normal. But nobody wants to get sick, and this is still very. Look, that's. I mean, I joke around. We all joke around about it, but this is still very much a very serious virus. This is a very lethal virus. And one that can create all kinds of, we've seen havoc both on the healthcare side and on the business side. So we're going to be talking about this well into the summer and certainly into the fall. But I do think right now, it's in terms of what happens, schools returning to classes, I'm sure that the government will roll out a plan and the state will roll out a plan and local governments, but all those plans are going to be dependent on that. How many cases we see in this spike? You know, what will be the ability of the healthcare network, including hospitals, to deal with them?
Yeah, they're very proud of having flattened the curve, at least to a degree, back in late March and early April. That was the alarm, the idea that we could over run hospital and health services. That's what led to the April shutdown. Then they felt confident that they had to overcome that. So they relaxed the openings. And here we are now into phase two, well into phase two in the month of June. But we could be sliding backwards a little bit once those hospitalization numbers start shrinking as far as the availability of beds. Well, it does look like there's going to be some tourists coming to town, though. We got Republicans are poised to name Jacksonville as the site for at least a major portion of their national convention after moving at least the big celebratory parts of it away from Charlotte, North Carolina, where it was planned for late August. The Democratic governor there said it could only take place with major social distancing and other limits on attendance, which Trump said no to. And enter Jacksonville, where Mayor Lenny Curry is a former Florida Republican chairman, and Governor Ron DeSantis is one of the president's favorite Republican governors. Do you think Florida is smart to be offering, as a showcase, the city of Jacksonville at this time for your Palm Beach County neighbor there, President Trump?
Well, I think you just spelled it out. They really didn't have much of a choice. You know, Lenny Curry is a former Florida Republican Party chairman, and the governor obviously arguably owes his political standing to the president's endorsement back in the 2018 gubernatorial race. So Florida, you know, the interesting thing about this is that the choice of Florida speaks to, I think, that they are worried that this state, which has been one of the ones and the strongest in favor of the president, where he was more popular, a very strong Republican base behind him. This is a state that, if you look at the polls, that is in play. And I think that by putting it in Jacksonville, it's a way to get the machines, you know, get it excited, get some exuberance behind the president. Plus, remember, you know, Jacksonville is half 50% Northeast Florida, 50% Southeast Georgia. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, it's an opportunity. That's another state where, you know, that I think you look at where the polls are looking at, and it is in play. So I think it's an opportunity to basically, create enthusiasm for the president and help, you know, lock down these states for the Trump 2020 campaign. You know, from a public health emergency, Sandy, well, look, it's leaving North Carolina for a reason. You know, the governor of North Carolina and health officials there believe that a major congregation, and that's the key here, is that the president has said, I don't want a virtual convention. I want a traditional convention. It's part of his statement that, you know, we're back in business, we're moving ahead, we're past the pandemic. That's his message. And, you know, it's leaving North Carolina for a reason. So from a public health perspective, is it smart? It's certainly risky, but yeah. Just as opening the beaches and opening the hotels and everything else we're doing has a certain amount of risk. But they're going full steam ahead. Now, the interesting thing, and I throw in a little bit of professional football history here. If you recall, I believe it was Super Bowl 39, which was between the Patriots and the Philadelphia Eagles. It was played in Tampa. Jacksonville.
Jacksonville, yeah.
And if you recall, one of the issues that the NFL had with the Super Bowl there was the availability of hotels. And what they did was that they brought up all these cruise ships to offer hotel space. So I wonder if they're going to do the same thing, which it's going to be interesting. You know, if you're going to be housing people for the GOP convention aboard cruise ships, you know, given the way that this pandemic rolled out and the vulnerability of cruise ships when it rolled out, this is all one big roll of the dice, but I can tell you that Republicans will be there. If it's Jacksonville, they will be there in a big number. And you know what? So will we, covering it.
Oh, absolutely. And I think as you point out, I think that is a concern now too. Indeed, that they're uncertain about whether, even if this cruise ship option was available, just how many of the delegates want to go on a cruise ship right now. You know, I mean, these cruise ship cabins are not very large or luxurious in most cases. And there was the pandemic really took hold on a lot of these ships when they were out at sea back in March and April. So there's kind of a bad, aftermath of the impact of these cruise ships, and the idea of housing yourself on one during the convention is a little bit alarming, I think, to some delegates. But Jacksonville does not have the space when it comes to hotel rooms. And indeed, when it came to why Jacksonville, There was also resistance from Tampa and Orlando, two cities that have pretty much ample hotel space. Tampa has even hosted the Republican convention before in 2012. But I think there was concern about the Democratic mayors in those cities do not really, they want to do the same kind of social distancing that the governor of North Carolina was wanting. So it took them off the table too. Now, Antonio, before we even get to the convention, there are Trump Team 2020 rallies planned for this weekend, right?
Yes, they are here in Palm Beach County and a few other cities around the state. And a little bit of background, Trump Team 2020 is a number of, obviously they're Trump fans and they're Republicans, but they don't call themselves Republicans. They call themselves Trumplicans. And that's an interesting phrase, because what it speaks to is that their allegiance is to the president more so than the party. And they have been for at least the better part of this year, if not going the last year or so, ever since the midterms, they've been very disenchanted with the Florida Republican Party. They don't think the Florida GOP is doing enough and voter registration enough to basically promote the effort to reelect the president. Notwithstanding the fact that the president has a 90% plus approval rating among Florida Republicans, but there is a lot of tension between the Trump Team 2020 and these Trump clubs and the official establishment of the Florida Republican Party. So this is, they're going to do a voter registration drive on Sunday. I'll tell you a little bit what they're going to do. They're going to, here in Palm Beach County, they're going to have a boat parade that's going to go all the way down to the vicinity of Mar-a-Lago. And then they're going to have a motorcycle rally and then this truck rally, and they're going to converge and eventually at two locations have voter registration efforts. So it's their way of saying, look, it's a way of sending a, they're sending almost more of a message to the president than to the public. And the message to the president is, we're the ones that are going to get you reelected. And so favor us. So we've seen this tension, this dynamic of the president, all president's base almost being a separate political entity than the actual Republican Party. And this Trump Team 2020 effort and these rallies are an embodiment of that.
Yeah, and it's right in his backyard, not too far from Mar-a-Lago. So I guess it helps underscore that he has this loyal following. And I guess the same loyal following feels that the Republican Party of Florida is not doing enough. Would that be the message?
Yeah, they've been saying that, and they have been very vocal about it. This is not something that's under the surface. They come out and they tell you from the start. And they have not been, I'll tell you right now, they have not been too happy with Governor DeSantis. One of the issues that they have been angry about is that at the beginning of the pandemic, during the government shutdown, when you had a bunch of businesses and services labeled essential and non-essential, they were very unhappy that abortions remained essential services and were able to continue. They wanted the governor to list abortions and abortion clinics as non-essential, to shut them down. The governor didn't do it, and they're very unhappy about that.
Interesting. Let's go back to those numbers that we started the show off with. Antonio, you had, what was it, 813?
No, 818. I had 818. Sorry. Yes. And actually, it's not really so much a number. It's a date. It's August 18th of this year. And that is the day of the primary. There is an election that day, in which Republicans and Democrats and other affiliated parties, but mostly Republican Democrats, will choose their candidates for local office, state office, and federal office for the November 3rd election. And this is kind of a historic year. I mean, we have a lot of candidates that have filed to run in the primaries. And in fact, all the Palm Beach County members of Congress, all of them have a primary appointment. And that's good. I mean, it's good for democracy. It's great that, the Democratic Party actually has said that they're going to field candidates for every state house and state Senate seat. And that's great for democracy. That is a sign of a healthy, vibrant political system. The problem is that we have a pandemic. And what we're seeing right now is that pandemic is really playing to the advantage of incumbents. Incumbents are getting quite the platform to come out to speak out about everything. Whereas the rivals, the challengers, are really hamstrung by the inability to run a campaign, to run a vibrant, very public, out there, hitting the the streets campaign and knocking on doors, that they're not able to do that, and they're very hamstrung. So it's kind of a double-edged sword for Florida democracy this year, that you have a lot of voter and hopefully vote enthusiasm, but a lot of candidate enthusiasm, but unfortunately a playing field that is seems to be skewed toward the incumbents simply because they're getting a platform that the rivals simply can't muster.
And it also raises some of those same questions that we have still unanswered about how this November election is going to be carried out, and the primaries in front of them as well. When it comes to, are we going to expand mail-in voting at all? How are you going to get people to the polls, where it's going to be hard to get poll workers, and also just trying to space people in what is expected to be a epic turnout if the election were held normally. Well, Antonio, my number is 36,869, and that's the number of coronavirus tests that the state has been averaging each day in the week since June 2nd, which was the first day of this month that Florida saw what is now the beginning of this 1,000-plus daily increase in the virus, as far as the caseloads go. That the state had pretty much fallen below that 1,000 benchmark for the month of May, but the 36,869 tests daily, that's a significant average. It's about 5,000 more than what public health experts have been saying for a long time now, that the state should be averaging each day, given its population. But most days, the state came nowhere near that, struggling usually to reach 20,000 or sometimes far less than that in April and much of the month of May. In fact, that public health recommended level was never reached until 4 days in mid-May. So testing coming around, as we say, it's yielding more cases. But a lot of people think that may not be the only reason that we're getting more cases now in mostly reopened Florida. So it's a conundrum that the state is facing right now. Where do you go, and what are we going to see in coming weeks? Well, that's all the time we have for today. And I'd like to thank our producers, Thomas Cordy and Joe Forzano, and our usual podcast partner, Zach Anderson of the Sarasota Herald Tribune. We'll be back with us next week. And thank you all to our good listeners. Meantime, stay safe, Florida.